The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
CARE versus the Constitution. A health professional diagnoses last week's Supreme Court arguments over health reform.
The persistence of profiling. Testimony on Capitol Hill. New police videos from the Trayvon Martin killing. And the hoodie factor.
The e-privacy debate. Who should do what with information about your life online? Can an employer demand access to your Facebook, past, present, and future?
Mad over Mad Men. TV's retro hit is back. But some former fans are more angry than entranced.
Hunger for Hunger Games, despite warnings about the excessive violence of teens on screen, and some other recent films to consider.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of Gatewave.org, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of April 1st, no fooling, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
Why do you define the market that broadly? Healthcare. It may well be that everybody needs healthcare sooner or later, but not everybody needs a heart transplant. Not everybody needs a liver transplant.
That's correct, Scalia, but you never know whether you're going to be
Could you
that
define
person.
The market? Everybody has to buy food sooner or later, so you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
No, it's quite different. It's quite different. The food market, while it shares that trait that everybody's in it, it is not a market in which your participation is often unpredictable and often involuntary.
That exchange between Justice Antonin Scalia and U.S. Solicitor General Donald Verrilli and others like it before the Supreme Court last week left many supporters of the administration's embattled health care reform more than a little disappointed. It took some other justices to underscore the larger point that not buying insurance places bigger health care costs on the rest of society in a way that not buying broccoli never could. Indeed, a later questioning by the judges suggested that there was also high court recognition of the partisan divide on this issue and the fact that eliminating the individual insurance mandate could undermine the entire reform plan, creating complex and chaotic health care consequences.
Even the wisest legal scholars know not to prejudge the judge's final vote on the basis of their oral arguments. So instead, for your ears only, we have the reaction of a medical professional on the front lines of local health care. He's Dr. Ricky Choi, department head of pediatrics at the Asian Health Services Community Health Center in Oakland. He's also on the board of directors of the National Physicians Alliance, which joined with the National Hispanic Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, and similar groups, in an amicus brief to the High Court supporting the individual mandate. Dr. Choi, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Did you think the administration made as strong a case as you had expected for the Affordable Health Care Act in general and the individual mandate in particular?
Well, the Affordable Care Act is the most important health care law in the past 50 years, and that will allow 30 million uninsured people access to health insurance. And for most of us who already have health insurance, provide some really important protections so insurance companies cannot take away your insurance if you have a pre-existing condition and also to provide free preventive care. Now, whether or not the administration made a strong enough case will be determined when the Supreme Court announces its decision at the end of June.
The individual insurance mandate has yet to take effect, but many other elements of the ACA have, including, as you noted, forbidding insurance policies to be refused because of pre-existing medical conditions, including 500,000 young adults under coverage of their parents. What aspects of the ACA have most impacted your practice?
Yeah, I think that many people don't realize that we're already 2 years into implementing the ACA, and millions have already benefited. At least last year, 54 million people with private health plans had at least one free preventive service, 32.5 million Medicare seniors received at least one preventive benefit, and as you mentioned, 2.5 million young adults under 26 are now under their insurance of their parents, including some of the staff in my clinic. Now, as a pediatrician, provisions that keep insurance companies from denying health coverage for pre-existing conditions is really critical. Pre-existing conditions can include common problems like diabetes and asthma. And as a federally qualified community health center, my center is already making use of some of the $11 billion that will be going towards expanding community health centers so that we can double the number of patients that we care for.
How much of the ACA do you think could remain in effect if the Supreme Court strikes down only the individual mandate?
Well, as you had mentioned before, you know, and no one knows for certain, there are pieces of the law such as increasing funding for primary care doctors in rural areas or allowing young adults under 26 to get under their parents' plan and some small provisions that may be able to continue. But removing the individual mandate will hollow out the core objective of the ACA, which is to make insurance available to more people and make premiums more affordable.
Talk about the burden on personal health and the healthcare system that you see from folks who now go without insurance.
Well, just this past week, I saw a child whose parents suspected that their child had ADHD. Their grades had really fallen and they were having problems in school. But dad owns a jewelry shop, is getting by but not doing great. His income, it was still too high for Medicaid, but health insurance in the private market was just simply unaffordable. So, unfortunately, his son has few available options for therapy and treatment. There was also a patient who came to our center for a cough in the past. He was a small business owner, but again, because of the high cost of insurance, didn't buy it for himself. And so he did what a lot of people do when they don't have health insurance. He waited, and he waited until his cough became so severe it interfered with his daily activity. So he shows up at our center, sees one of our doctors, and we suspect that it's cancer. Now, because he now has a pre-existing condition, his insurance options would cover very little and probably be prohibitively expensive. And so he sought some other options, but ultimately he died shortly afterwards. And there are so many stories just like this one. Now, if this were to happen in 2014, with ACA still upheld, this patient would be able to get health insurance because his pre-existing condition would not have been affected would not have affected his ability to get insurance.
The Supreme Court also heard arguments on the ACA's expansion of Medicaid, with Washington paying most of the added cost. But some states complaining that the increase in their share is too burdensome. How do you see that debate?
Well, the expansion of Medicaid for everyone under 133% of poverty will add coverage for 17 million people. And states do share the cost with the federal government, but the federal government will cover up to 90% of the cost for these new beneficiaries, according to the ACA. So this is not a new situation. Medicaid has been expanded many times in the past, and the court has never rejected a Medicaid expansion.
The White House seems to want it known that they are so sure of the ACA's constitutionality, including the mandate, that they have no plan B if the High Court disagrees. If really true, that seems at least a bit irresponsible to many people. What's your view?
Well, we all watched the drama a few years ago that unfolded as the ACA was pieced together and eventually passed. And frankly, I think almost anything that would have passed would have been attacked. The administration appears pretty confident that the Supreme Court will decide in favor of the ACA.
Is your health center in Oakland making any provisional plans for carrying on if the mandate or the entire Affordable Health Care Act is judged unconstitutional?
Royal Health Center is committed to continue providing high-quality care regardless of how the Supreme Court decides. However, we have already started making changes in anticipation of the expansion and coverage that will begin in 2014 by making capital investments so that we can take on and, in fact, almost double the number of patients that we see. So we strongly hope that the ACA is upheld. Here in California, the governor's administration just announced a few days ago that even if the ACA is shut down or struck down, they'll consider enacting legislation to provide universal health care with an individual mandate. You know, California was the first state to set up health insurance exchange, and it's estimated that 2 million Californians will get insurance through that exchange.
Dr. Ricky Choi is Department Head of Pediatrics at the Asian Health Services Community Health Center in Oakland, California. He's also on the board of directors of the National Physicians Alliance, which joined with the National Hispanic Medical Association, the American Nurses Association, and similar groups in an amicus brief to the High Court supporting the individual mandate.
Quote from the news, "We shouldn't expect any miracles." That was French Prime Minister François Fillon lowering expectations on a pending international agreement to draw down petroleum reserves as high gas prices become a strong political issue in France as well as the United States.
Next, the persistence of profiling and Trayvon Martin for Your Ears Only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. After the election, I will have more flexibility. That was President Obama on an accidentally open mic at the Seoul Summit on Nuclear Threats, asking Russian President Dmitry Medvedev for more time to work out a compromise on missile defense plans. Republican leaders quickly complained about a secret White House agenda. At the summit, Obama warned that too much nuclear material was still vulnerable to rogue groups and called on North Korea to scrap plans for a satellite launch that could also be a strategic missile test. Pyongyang refused. Now this.
Just because someone wears a hoodie does not make them a hoodlum. The Bible teaches us, Mr. Speaker, in the book of Micah 6:6-8,
the member will suspend.
These words.
I'm going to say it like I see it. Trayvon was hunted down like a rabid dog. He was shot in the street. He was racially profiled.
African-American Congressman Bobby Rush of Illinois was caught off for wearing a hoodie on the House floor last week in support of slain teenager Trayvon Martin. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson of Florida was even more pointed at a news conference outside. And Congressman John Conyers of Michigan was among other Democrats who organized a full-fledged congressional forum, though not an official hearing, on the role of the federal government and hate crimes.
In Sanford, Florida, meanwhile, more protests were organized to press for arrest of George Zimmerman, the neighborhood watch volunteer who followed an unarmed Martin against police advice, then shot him dead in what he claimed was self-defense under Florida's Stand Your Ground law. New police video shows Zimmerman handcuffed with no obvious signs of major struggle, but he was quickly released without charges. To consider the case and the larger issues of racial profiling, police prejudice, neighborhood watch rules, and Stand Your Ground, for your ears only, we have Dennis Parker, director of the American Civil Liberties Union Racial Justice Program and a witness at that Capitol forum. Welcome.
Thank you.
Were you surprised to see Zimmerman in cuffs at the police station in that video? And does that support accounts that at least some cops initially assumed he would be arrested?
I was surprised for a couple of reasons. One, the one you give, that it shows that he was taken into custody, and clearly a decision was made after that to release him. And, of course, it also shows that he didn't suffer the type of physical injuries you'd expect for someone who claimed he had been beaten before he took the step of shooting Trayvon.
Part of your testimony focused on past cases in which the Sanford Police Department showed prejudice or favoritism when race was involved.
Right. There were a couple of incidents, one involving the shooting of a young black teen in the back by private security guards. The other involved the son of a member of the Sanford Police Department who beat up a homeless black man and was not charged with anything. And the video shows that it was an unprovoked attack. So it appears to be something that's happened more than once, where the police department has let go someone who is engaged in very violent and unprovoked conduct.
Is it reasonable for investigators in this case to determine if police knew that Zimmerman's father is a retired judge and if that played any role in the way they treated him after that video we saw of him in cuffs?
I think fairness requires that the investigation cover every possible aspect of the case, including that. Anything that shows that the decision to release Zimmerman wasn't based on the facts, but based on his connections or police bias or any number of other things that would deny Trayvon his rights.
The FBI is investigating Zimmerman's comments to see if Martin's race, not his hoodie, was the motivating factor for suspicion. If so, could this killing be classified as a hate crime, even if Zimmerman was not otherwise an obvious racist?
Yes. I mean, the point of the hate crime legislation is to create, to make it a separate crime to target someone because of their race or ethnicity or other protected category. So it really doesn't matter whether or not, you know, you don't have to prove the person is a racist. And in fact, the only important thing is whether the person acts in a way because of the person's race.
We know Zimmerman ignored police by following Martin, and we know that he had a license to carry a concealed weapon. But is being armed usual for Citizens Watch volunteers or a violation of the terms under which most of them operate?
Absolutely not. In fact, all Citizens Watch programs forbid the carrying of weapons.
if charges are finally brought against Zimmerman, some say that ignoring the police to follow Martin should rule out his protection under Stand Your Ground, even if Martin did finally turn on him. Even one of the law's initial sponsors says it's misapplied here. What's your view on that law and such laws in general?
Well, I think, you know, there are really two questions there. One is whether or not it's properly invoked here. And I think, you know, certainly the evidence that I've heard and is that he did pursue him after being told not to. The Stand Your Ground law, as it's written, is supposed to say that you don't need to retreat, which is the standard common law requirement. So this is not a question of his not retreating, but his actually chasing someone. But the larger question is really whether or not these laws are a good thing. And I think that there are a lot of reasons to be very concerned about them. There's been an increase in the number of shootings where people invoke the law and where people have ultimately gotten off because of it. I think that they're really problematic. They've been described as a shoot first, ask questions later law. And I think that there's a lot of real fear that these kinds of laws may increase the number of unjustified shootings.
You testified in support of the End Racial Profiling Act. What kind of behavior and by whom would it cover?
Well, the act specifically covers federal agents, and it covers all federal law enforcement agents. It requires training, and it creates the possibility of getting court relief to make sure that it is complied with. But it's important because it also permits the federal government to require that any states getting federal funding keep the sort of data about police activities that can determine whether or not racial profiling is going on by state enforcement actors. It can also it would also create funding so that the federal government could fund states to put into place programs designed to reduce racial profiling.
You also called for strengthening the Department of Justice guidance regarding the use of race by federal law enforcement. What would that entail?
There are three things that we were concerned about with the guidance as it exists now. And the first one is that it exempts certain law enforcement activities, such as border security and national security. And, you know, we fear that these things that actions may take place under those circumstances that should be covered by the act or by the guidelines and are not. The second thing is that it's limited in that it doesn't cover religion or national origin, and that's an area where we see increasing racial profiling. So we think it needs to be included in the guidelines.
Does the word hoodie have to be put into the law so that attire can't be used as an excuse?
Well, certainly, it is incredible that we'd be having a discussion about whether or not it's someone's fault because of what they wear that they were attacked and killed.
Dennis Parker is director of the American Civil Liberties Union Racial Justice Program and a witness at the Capitol Forum.
Quote from the news, the regime pretended that they agreed, but what happened? That was Syrian National Council member Walid Banani on continuing Syrian government violence after President Bashar al-Assad's okay to a ceasefire and peace plan backed by Arab nations and the UN. Continued rebel killing of high-ranking army officers also threatened to keep the peace plan stalled.
Next, threats to the privacy of life online. For your ears only.
We have more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. At the end of the day, it's a matter of image, a matter of recognition, a matter of reputation. That was Georgetown University professor of global logistics Ricardo Ernst on the report that Foxconn, China's major producer of Apple electronic products, has given into pressure for reforms, including limiting hours in the work week and improving factory environment, which had 43 health violations. A computer security firm in Tokyo, meanwhile, traced the hacking of companies in Japan and India and Tibetan activists to Chinese groups with a government connection. Now this.
How would you feel about your employer playing around with your Facebook account? Some companies have asked for prospective employees' logins during the interview process, and both Facebook and some U.S. senators aren't exactly clicking like.
A Slate.com news video. E-privacy was a very public issue last week. First, Democratic Senators Chuck Schumer of New York and Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut asked for Justice Department and Equal Employment Opportunity Commission investigations of companies asking for job seekers' Facebook logins. Then the Federal Trade Commission issued a report urging that Congress enact general privacy legislation and web-involved companies provide purchasers with privacy options, both more simple and transparent.
Apple, meanwhile, started rejecting apps that access UDIDs, the numerical identifiers for each iPad and iPhone. And Yahoo said it will add Do Not Track options across its entire global network. To examine the growing concern over e-privacy and the growing commerce and data about all our lives online, for your ears only, we have Declan McCullough, Chief Political Correspondent at CNET. Declan, welcome to our program.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with Facebook shakedowns. What are some of the employers asking for that kind of online look-see?
I think this is one of those political controversies. It's become a political controversy that is a bit overstated. There aren't many employers who are actually doing this. A North Carolina Police Department was one of them. The Maryland Division of Corrections, which wanted to weed out potential gang affiliations among potential prison guards, is another. I mean, you can really count these on one hand. Nevertheless, it's something that has resonated in the internet community, and it scared a lot of people, especially during this tough job environment. And so it's gotten a lot of attention, even though it seems to be not really that much of a trend if there are only less than five entities doing it.
Does a request for a job seeker's Facebook access compare legally with watching the person page through it himself or just asking directly about very personal matters?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, in fact, you put your finger on it. The difference is that Facebook about a week ago said, well, if our terms of service don't allow you to give out your password to, say, a prospective employer. So if you, a prospective employer, are asking for someone's password, you're violating the terms of service. And if push comes to shove and there's ever a lawsuit, then you, this employer, could be civilly liable for inducing breach of contract. And so this is a long way to say that Facebook has made it more difficult for employers to ask for someone's password as long as they want to be on the right side of the law. But it doesn't address the second point, which is, okay, I'm not asking for your password, but here's a laptop. Please log in, poke around, and I'll look over my shoulder. And that is something that they could still do even after Facebook's change to its policies. And it's going to be difficult for Facebook to restrict that because sometimes you want someone to look over your shoulder like, hey, look at these photos I just posted.
If a job seeker refuses Facebook access now and does not get hired, does he or she have any legal recourse?
It depends. There's no specific law at the state or federal level. There's been talk of such laws, and there's one that was voted down by the House of Representatives this week. But there's no law saying that if you refuse to give up your Facebook password, that you have some sort of legal recourse. But in reality, employers have to be a little careful because if they see something in someone's Facebook account, a prospective hire's Facebook account that deals with things like attempting to organize a union, that's protected under federal law. If you're not hired because you disclosed your religion or sexual orientation, that would violate federal law, and some states like California have laws that go further. So employers have to be a little careful, but in general, if an employer wants your Facebook, wants to poke around your Facebook account, perhaps shoulder surfing, and you refuse and you don't get hired, you're out of luck.
If history is any judge, you wrote last week, soon job seekers will be savvy enough to clean up their online histories or actually buy products that do.
That's the reality of it. If this were a static environment and prospective employees didn't actually know what was going on, then this might actually work on the part of an employer. But in reality, prospective employers are going to know that this company you're applying for does this. You set up a fake Twitter account, you set up a fake Gmail account or a fake Facebook account. And here's my password. Log in. This is the sanitized version. So it's I think that if this becomes more widespread, then you're just going to have people setting up two accounts, and then the employer has to say, well, I mean, is this really the account or not? And they're not generally in a position to know whether it's real or not.
What are an employer's rights to fire people because of what they say or do online once they've been hired? And does it make any difference if the activity is done during work hours or other times?
Well, if you're doing things like trash-talking your employer, yeah, you're out the door. If you're doing things like disclosing information about company meetings, even if you think it's innocuous, yeah, you're probably out the door as well. Things that can limit an employer's right to fire you. Now, keep in mind that most jobs in the United States are at will, right? I mean, you can leave at any time, and your employer can make you leave at any time. Now, if you have a contract, if you're a union employee with a contract, if you're an executive with a contract, you're often protected from being fired without a just cause. But the things that can get an employer in trouble would be firing someone over religion that was disclosed on a blog, sexual orientation that was disclosed in a blog, attempting to organize a union, which led to a National Labor Relations Board complaint against a Connecticut company 2 years ago. I mean, but in reality, these are relatively narrow categories. Apple has fired employees for making negative comments about the company. An Australian government employee was fired for using Google to search for relatively tame, but probably not entirely work-appropriate things. So, yeah, you've got to be careful what you're doing on or off the job, because this is at will. They can make you leave and you can leave.
Declan McCullough is a chief political correspondent at CNET.
Quote from the news, the end of his line. That was the verdict of Las Vegas billionaire Sheldon Adelson on Newt Gingrich, to whose GOP presidential effort he has donated millions. Frontrunner Mitt Romney further solidified his lead with endorsements from Florida Senator Marco Rubio, congressional conservative leader Paul Ryan, and former President George H.W. Bush.
Next, not so mad about the new Mad Men. For your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. Authentic freedom. That was what Pope Benedict XVI called for on his visit to Cuba. But he did not meet with dissidents, criticized the U.S. embargo, and found, quote, joy that in Cuba, steps have been taken to enable the church to carry out her essential mission. Now this.
Zooby, zooby, zoo.
Almost everything seems more sophisticated and sexy in French, but for many, watching the fifth season opener of Mad Men on AMC TV last week after an 18-month hiatus, even that sultry song and dance by the new young wife of sexy star Don Draper at his surprise birthday party was not enough to revive the original magic of the 60s retro series. Critic Adam Buckman of XfinityTV.com and AdamBuckman.com found himself using a word that he never before associated with Mad Men, boring. And for Your Ears Only, he's on the line now to say why. Adam Buckman, welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've been a fairly firm fan of Mad Men until now. What did you think made it so appealing to audiences and award voters, besides the 60s wardrobes and a lot of smoking that is now such a vicarious pleasure for so many of us?
Well, the thing is that the 60s accoutrements, you know, the settings and the clothing are wonderful window dressing for the show and certainly play a role in the show. But for me, traditionally, the stuff that was always better was the dramatizations, the acting and the script writing and the storytelling. You know, these other elements were, you know, secondary and should have always been secondary, because what the show was really good at was kind of putting you in a place in time without you kind of believing that they're making believe about the 1960s. That's what I always used to like about the show the most. It was right there and in the moment, and a contemporary dramatization that just happened to take place in the 1960s.
What were the most painful differences in Mad Men's fifth season debut?
The big difference for me was a kind of a gut feeling you get when you're a critic and you, unfortunately, or for better or for worse, watch and consume entertainment with a critical eye all the time. And sometimes this doesn't help you enjoy things. But when I was watching it, I was fidgety and I was a little bit restless. and I looked at my watch, and I wondered how much longer is this going to go on. And then after I did those things, I thought to myself, hey, man, this is Mad Men. That never happened to me before. And it happened during the very party scene you were talking about. And the party scene, to me, just seemed to drag on and on. And, you know, with little set pieces where these two people would talk to that one person, and then it would switch across the room to three other people. And then there was the Zooby Zooby Zoo performance, which became kind of a big hit, so-called, on iTunes, apparently, David. So I guess there was a lot of people who got a kick out of the novelty of the performance. But for me, it was just a showstopper in a bad way.
Well, she was pretty hot. I actually worked on Madison Avenue in the 60s at Newsweek, which combined some elements of advertising and journalism. I missed in Mad Men a greater sense of the work these people actually do, pride and creativity, cleverness that emerged in those days. Mostly what I saw was status consciousness and ego. Was that typical of the series from the start?
No, and that's another thing. The workplace scenes were, to me, not as effective as they had been in the past either. I think I might have made a comment in the column I wrote that the sets and the furnishings looked more like displays at IKEA or a furniture store like Design Within Reach than an actual office where work is performed.
We posted
the piles of paper were too neat. The inboxes had nothing spilling out of them. You know, this kind of thing. I mean, you know, I guess they might say if someone from the show was talking to us, they might say, well, they had maybe just moved into the office or yada, yada, yada. But you know what? Offices are not that neat. And it didn't seem like a lot of sweat was coming off of anyone's brow as they kind of went around. And Don Draper, as usual, was leaving work early. You know, the guy never seems to work and never has a cluttered desk. And that's suspicious to me.
Don Draper is now pretty lovesick over his new bride. Was he more interesting in his earlier unhappily married, merrily misogynistic years?
Without question. And well, certainly it remains to be seen whether he'll cheat this season or not. One of the things that's different this season now with this new relationship with Megan is they work in the same office. And that takes away a key element of Mad Men, which was always this dichotomy where in the 60s, you know, your family was up in the suburbs of Westchester and the man could come down to the city and basically spend the day there untethered by communications technology to anybody. And I guess one of the points of the show was this sort of situation would allow men to basically do whatever they want, and Manhattan for Don Draper was kind of this playground while his family was not in the know and they were up in the suburbs. Now this time around he's married to somebody who reports to him in the office, and we lack now the great marriage between Don and Betty Draper. To me, was the most interesting centerpiece of the show, and they had them get divorced. So now we don't have, you know, that image of Ken and Barbie, the beautiful woman and beautiful handsome man, who are actually with real-life cracks in their relationship. I wish they had just kept them going as a marriage, but a marriage with tension. And that was what was really interesting for me, and now that's gone.
You're not the only critic to have found fault with this long-delayed season opener. Do folks behind a hit series like this take criticism to heart, or are they committed to their dramatic arc and tone and ratings and critics be damned?
Well, I think, like it really depends on the individual. I know that if I go online, and as I do, as we all do, who write online and have relatively public opinions, you go online and you are concerned or at least curious about how people are reacting to you. And sometimes when they react harshly, yeah, it can sting a little bit. But the thing about these people, and I can't really speak for them personally, for all I know, Matthew Weiner is upset when he reads a column that denigrates his show. But I think at this point in the history of Mad Men, the creators, producers, and writers of it are so probably wrapped up and taken in by the magazine covers and the plaudits and applause that they get from most critics, that they probably have this sort of omniscient belief that they are untouchable and can do no wrong. I imagine that in this particular point in the cycle of this show, they are just not even paying attention to criticism because they believe they've made the biggest success that anyone is talking about at the moment in television. So why should they listen to anybody who might identify cracks in what they're doing?
Adam Buckman of XfinityTV.com and AdamBuckman.com, where he posts a continuing blog of his 30-year career.
Quote from the news, "We need to take a leap of faith." That was one of the rants attributed by an FBI affidavit to a JetBlue captain who was subsequently locked out of the cockpit by his co-pilot and subdued by passengers, including, ironically, a contingent of security professionals.
Next, Hunger for the Hunger Games, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "These executives should be phased on heavy stun." That was Star Trek fan Harmon Fields of Manhattan on CBS withholding an okay for use of a never-used script from the original Star Trek series for an amateur web version, despite the approval of Arthur Norman Spinrad. Now this.
"What did you say to your sister when you volunteered at the reaping?"
"I told her that I would try to win for her."
"And try you will.
I just keep wishing that I could think of a way to show them that they don't own me. If I'm gonna die, I want to still be me.
I just can't afford to think like that."
Do you smell the birth of a franchise? Opening weekend sales for The Hunger Games, originally projected at $70 million, actually hit a surprising $150 million, the third highest opening weekend ever, trailing only last year's Harry Potter finale at $170 million and 2008's Batman sequel, The Dark Knight, at just under $160 million.
Based on the trilogy by Suzanne Collins, The Hunger Games, the film version, depicts a dystopian America where children are forced to fight to the death in a televised gladiator-style reality show where only one can survive. Like the books, the film features violent scenes of children being shot, stabbed, and beaten to death by other children. Should our children see it? Should we? For guidance, for your ears only, we turn again to KCBS Radio Entertainment editor and critic Jan Wall, also a lecturer and film historian at janwall.com. Welcome back to our program.
Great to be here with you. I love hearing about The Hunger Games, and I love talking about it.
How much of the film's appeal comes from its young Oscar-nominated heroine, Jennifer Lawrence, and how do you think she does?
First of all, she does absolutely beautiful as Katniss Everdeen. But let me tell you why this movie appeals to people of all ages. I mean, yes, I'm very happy. Move over Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings because it's got young people reading books. Hats off to that. But it reminds me also of The Truman Show and even a little bit of one of my favorite movies of all time, Network, Paddy Chayefsky's Network. Because remember, one of the plots in that movie was about an anchorman being killed for ratings. So here we're talking about a TV show that has kids killing each other in this kind of gladiator meets survivor show style. And I think she does very well, Jennifer Lawrence. It's not just the actors, though. It's this wonderful, the way the plot keeps moving. The director keeps the plot moving. Gary Ross keeps the plot moving ahead. I mean, it's motion pictures that actually has motion. And it takes us deep into the story. Plus, you've got flamboyant Stanley Tucci as the host, and you've got Woody Harrelson. And any time the intense Woody Harrelson shows up, a movie is made better.
Now that so many kids and young teens have seen it, do you think more adults will now start to ride the hunger wave, which could generate even more revenue for the film?
You know, I think, yeah, if it's possible, even more. First of all, kids will go over and over again. The reason we've got a Hollywood that appeals to kids, they mostly want to make movies for kids, is because they go over and over again. They go the first week. They are critic-proof. They don't care what critics say. They buy the merchandise. They really buy the merchandise and all the tie-ins. And worldwide, it's easier to market to that age group. So there's a lot of reasons why this kind of age group does the kind of box office that it does. And The Hunger Games will, though, expand out because I am not that demographic, yet I find it a good film. It's actually, if you remember that it's making a statement on our reality show-drenched culture. And if you think of it that way, it becomes a far more interesting film, and I think that'll send older people to it.
But many parents are still concerned about the violent content and fear it could cause violent behavior or psychological distress in some young people. What's your view on that?
I think they're right. I think the parents should be worried, and I think they should be distressed about this. This is a very bad problem we've got in our culture in general. And, of course, video games are violent, and we've got a lot of violence coming at these kids in ways that they're not looking. I teach a class, and I do a lecture called Critical Thinking of the Mass Media for young people, and for everybody, where they try and be, I want them to be critical and say, wait, this is too violent, this is too cruel. And there is a lot of violence and cruelty in this brutal film, and I would hope 12 and up. I would hope kids 12 and under don't go, but that is who they're marketing to, and it's going to be hard for parents to keep those under 12s from seeing it.
On a related movie matter last week, what was your reaction to the campaign that got the Motion Picture Association to drop its planned R rating for the sometimes painful documentary Bully that might get kids to understand the harm mean behavior can really do?
It's one of the only times the board ever did anything I agreed with. I usually don't like their ratings. I usually think it's a sham and it's a corrupt system. Mm-hmm. This time, they should have dropped it. This time, this is a movie that kids should be in schools. This is this is a movie that should be shown mandatory in high schools. Kids need to see it. Bullying is something that is happening. It is a very painful documentary, but it's powerful, and it's something that kids need to see. So I am really pleased that that happened. That's one of the few times they've ever done anything I agree with.
On a lighter note, talk about the new British romantic comedy drama Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, starting with its writer and director and their past successes.
Oh man, that was one of the, that movie was, it had half of a really good movie in it, but as soon as it changed its tone. It went from this really fun comedy and crazy idea of this sheikh from Yemen who's determined to bring fishing into his country and make it a big tourist thing, but as well make the people proud. And it turns into, unfortunately, a serious political commentary that deals with terrorism and internal strife in the country, and it takes the comedy out of it. I think it was a chance to be a comedy that really failed. So we need comedies these days. And what's so good is on DVD, there's a whole bunch of things that are coming, that are out, that are very good. And that includes The Descendants and My Week with Marilyn and, Hugo. All of these are now available to watch at home, which is fabulous.
Jian Wall is KCBS Radio Entertainment Editor and Critic, also lecturer and film historian at JianWall.com. And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. Aggravated pimping. That was the charge on which resigned IMF President Dominique Strauss-Kahn was arrested for allegedly facilitating a high-end prostitution ring and released on 100,000 euros bail.
For Your Ears Only on Air is online at YouTube, iTunes, and PodcastBunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donation. Please email davidearsonly@gmail.com to pledge.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at Play It Productions with interns Daniela Quintanilla and Kamana Larson. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern, acknowledging support from Gatewave.org, a nonprofit radio reading service, the century-old Carnegie Corporation of New York, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, and the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
Now we are back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Kaimana Larson. This week last year, we spoke with the author of an American Academy of Pediatrics report on the threats to tweens and teens online from our April 3rd, 2011 broadcast hosted by Eddie and David.
We don't know what it can be. We don't know what it will be. We know that it is cool. This is our thing.
From Hollywood's box office hit, The Social Network. And if the real-life creators of Facebook could not fully understand what it might mean for their college cohort, they were even less conscious of the potential impact on younger kids, wannabe tweens, and teens. A report released last week by the American Academy of Pediatrics notes both positive and negative effects, from easier social interaction, long-distance education, and community participation to the risk of real-world distraction, cyberbullying, and online rejection that can contribute to a new syndrome called Facebook depression.
Dr. Gwen O'Keefe, known as Dr. Gwen on the Pediatrics Now website she created, is author of the book Cyber Safe and co-author of that AAP report, The Impact of Social Media Use on Children, Adolescents, and Their Families. And she joins us now to talk about it for Your Ears Only. Welcome to our program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
First, give us an idea of how many kids are online, for how long, and in what different ways. Facebook, instant messaging, texting, potentially pornographic sexting, sending pictures of nudes, and intimate activity.
So we're talking millions and millions and millions. For the younger kids, the 2 to 11, we're talking really almost the amount of adult users for the Internet. About 16 million kids are online in that group, at least according to the most recent Nielsen estimates. That's about 9.5% of that population, which is staggering considering how young they are. For the teenagers, about 93% of teenagers are on, and that's in the 12 to 17-year-old age group. And about 20% of those kids are mobile, so they have cell phones. So that's a huge amount of kids worldwide.
Now, was this AAP report commissioned because pediatricians simply have become aware of all this activity, or are they seeing an increase in physical and mental health problems related to it?
In this case, we determined that there was a need for better guidance in social media because, as I just mentioned, so many kids are using it in all ages that we really thought with this many kids online and so much of it being social media, we needed to provide some guidance. There's already been some staggering headlines about kids committing suicide because of cyberbullying and sexting. Parents were unsure how to guide their children. Parents were struggling with their own technology issues. So it was time to really give people some guidance, pediatricians, and say, hey, this is what the landscape is. This is how you talk to people. This is why it's a health problem.
One problem is simply all the time involved and how it can distract from schoolwork, exercise, sleep, interaction with peers in the real world. Is there a reasonable time limit parents can put on social media activity at different age levels?
Well, when we talk about online, just screen time, we quote 2 hours of screen time a day for all age groups. And we do feel that that is a good amount of screen time, even for computer use and cell phone use in the mix. However, that really is focused on more entertainment use. When we talk about, you know, use for emergencies, for example, when it comes to cell phones or academic use, for teenagers, that time is going to be expanded a little bit. But I do feel parents need to watch the time and make sure kids have a healthy balance between using social media and having offline activities so that they have a balanced life.
One solution to the time problem and possible inappropriate behavior is the location of the home computer to which kids have access. Talk about that.
Well, back when computers first came out, we would talk a lot about having the home computer be, you know, somewhere visible, in a family room, for example, or in a kitchen area where there was a little desk set up. That's becoming more of a problematic recommendation now that everything's on the go. We live in a 24/7 portability culture now, so kids are accessing their computers now versus via laptops or even from smartphones. So to tell families that the computer should be in a central location is really not realistic. It's better to teach kids good habits on their computers with a focus on citizenship and have parents have a culture in their family where everybody works together and with more of an open-door policy so that wherever the child is working on the computer, especially a teenager, parents and kids can have good lines of communication because not everybody lives in a home where it's going to be feasible for people to do homework around the dinner table or the breakfast area or wherever that computer is existing. Kids may be in their room.
You also say parents should go online themselves to show they know the territory, maybe even create their own Facebook page and friend their own kid. How does that work? Sounds a little intrusive.
Well, people have to remember a number of things. The first is that you're a parent to your child, you're not a friend to your child. So you have to remember that if your child is a teenager, you're still parenting that child. You're not going to be just handing over the reins now that your kid is a teenager. I've got two teenagers at home, so I can say this with some amount of certainty that just because they turn 15, 16, or 13 doesn't mean that we walk away from what they're doing in their life. So we have to keep that in mind. The second is that they might look mature, but they're still developing, and they don't understand the idiosyncrasies of the online world the way they might figure out the offline world. So I think it's reasonable to have some home use rules for how these social media sites are used. And one rule that I think is important, and it's worked fine in my house as well as the house of many other people I know, is that if you want a Facebook page, I'm your friend.
And that way you get to see whatever they put up and what they're looking at as well.
Exactly. But I think with teenagers, it's appropriate to do it in a very low-keyed way so that you're not sort of being a net nanny, but you're doing it to mentor them through something. You're doing it to help them when Facebook changes their privacy policy. You're doing it to help them develop good posting habits and to understand how to post pictures appropriately. And if you see something, you can sit down and have a somewhat reasonable conversation with them as opposed to pointing a finger and accusing them of something, because they might not necessarily understand the implications of what they posted.
Dr. Gwen O'Keefe is author of the book CyberSafe and co-author of the American Academy of Pediatrics report, The Impact of Social Media Use on Children, Adolescents, and Their Families.
Teens at Risk Online, from our April 3, 2011 broadcast. Last week, Daily Show mock news anchor Jon Stewart said Spike Lee should, quote, leave the cyberbullying to teenagers, after the famous film director went on Twitter with the address of a couple he thought were parents of the Citizens Watch volunteer who shot Trayvon Martin, though in fact they were no relation at all. But teen cyberbullying is precisely the problem on which lawmakers in at least five states, Delaware, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, and New York, were reported working to enact or stiffen penalties. And under intense public pressure, as we heard earlier, the Motion Picture Association of America withdrew its planned R rating for the documentary Bully, though the film's lack of any MPAA designation may still lead theaters not to show it, particularly to many of the young people who would benefit most. I'm Kaimana Larson. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, Susanna McCorkle with more on the pitfalls of our computer age from her CD, Hearts and Minds.
We're in the computer age, where we headed for internet is all the rage, where we headed for cyberspace is really red, but it seems to be partly good and partly bad, I think. Scrolling down computer screens till our eyes are red, e-commerce and e-scenes, we should be in bed holding each other tight. Not cyber surfing all night. Megabyte and gigabyte are the bytes to beat. Spam and cookies, not the kind you eat. Geek is fear and piracy, there's no privacy. Hackers find out all about you, don't they? Never had so much information, but what about the art of conversation? I wish we could know where this'll go, where to? I was the last kid on my block to get TV. Now would you look at me? Laptop on pilot and DVD. We got a dichotomy, and it's either or a boon or a lobotomy, that we're heading for a major break in education, and it's almost free, but they said that about cable TV, yeah, right. Website, all right. Ageof.com and CD-ROM, where to? It's the age of email. We write letters more, pick yourself a screen name, and start looking for a bit of cyber company. You find that and more. Time goes by, emails fly, hello. You locate your cyber soulmate, you decide to meet, and you really hit it off. Things are looking sweet, you find out he's got a wife. It's just the same as real life. If you find cyberspace bewildering, and you probably do, think of all the little children stuck to screens like glue. They don't read books or hear good music, just computer tones, computer games, computer creatures. They turn the TV on, it's all material, Teletubbies, Pokemon, Oreo cookie, breakfast cereal. How will they find the life of the mind? Poor kids. People are spending all their time in cyberspace. It's got to learn its place. Get some control or you'll lose your soul. Internet economy. Go online and score. They got rich, so why not me? You invest some more. NASDAQ, Dow Jones. What's the price? Support, margin call, selling short. Uh-oh. Fast game. No blame. That's how it goes. No broker knows. Inspiration, see a museum site. If you're sick of edification, have a shopping night. Cyber spending round the clock, 7/24 discounts, stuff galore. eBay, okay. Oh, what a thrill till you get the bill. Now what? Where to? Information highway. Are you going my way? Chat room online. Your domain online. Hide behind your email. Be a male or female. Boolean operator. I'm online now, I'll catch you later. A giant leap for mankind. If it doesn't steal your mind, is it really way cool? Or a capitalist tool? Default backslash. Virus cursor crash. Once you start, you want more, but you wonder what's in store. So many temptations give us reservations. It's a tricky situation. What's our destination? We're in the computer age.